But just to get us started, can I get a little bit of background from both of you, where you grew up, how you were raised, and in what ways did your upbringing affect the way you viewed people of different races, cultures, religions? Kinder, we'll start with you, please.
Okay. I was born and reared mostly in Buffalo, New York. I did spend a couple of intermittent years in the great city of Detroit when it was a great city. I grew up mostly in Buffalo in an extended family. And what I mean by that is we all lived in the same neighborhood. But we lived in a neighborhood that was pretty homogenous. I mean, the only distinction I knew about race as a child growing up was how to identify three friends who were named Jeffrey. My grandmother, I had a friend named Jeffrey who happened to be African American. I had a friend named Jeffrey who was of Irish descent. And then I had a friend named Jeffrey who went to worship on Friday night because he was a Jew. So whenever one of them would come to the door, my mom would say, "Jeffrey is here." And I would holler, "Which one?" And she would never dignify it. And I told her, I said, "Ma, you got to tell me which Jeffrey is at the door." She said, "You boys can have whatever conversation you want among yourselves, but you're not going to pull me into that. Jeffrey is Jeffrey, whichever one it is." And so I learned very quickly that there shouldn't be distinctions. Even if you have multiplicity, it's not an excuse for singling someone out for their characteristics, especially their phenotypical qualities of which they have no control whatsoever. And when it comes to faith, young people initially don't have a choice. You're generally brought up in the faith of your parents. So Jeffrey was Jewish because his entire family was Jewish. And I even went to worship with Jeffrey on Friday evenings at the temple. And I never felt any different there. And then there was something my grandmother said to me consistently, and that was, "Everybody is at least as good as you are. Never think yourself more than anyone." And so those lessons were valuable as a kid. And that's pretty much how I grew up, right here in Buffalo, New York. And I lived in the old First Ward. So it was a pretty homogenous neighborhood.
And Matthew, what was your experience like?
I was born in St. Louis, but we moved to Chicago when I was 5 years old. And I lived in the neighborhood where the University of Chicago is located and the Museum of Science and Industry and some other interesting things, a neighborhood called Hyde Park on the south side of Chicago. And it's a neighborhood that prided itself when I was a kid with a rather bitter joke about it. It said it was the neighborhood where blacks and whites stood shoulder to shoulder to keep out the poor. So it was an interesting place. It was a racially integrated neighborhood, but it knew that it was not without problems. It's the neighborhood where the Obama family lived in Chicago when they lived there most recently. And there's a lot to love about it. I went to a racially integrated school, and those were both things that I knew were true when I was little and that I knew that my family valued and took pride in. And the kids that I played with in my neighborhood were both black and white and some of mixed race families. And, you know, you'd go out the back door towards the big open vacant lot in the middle of the block and just holler, and other kids would come out of their houses too, and then you'd start a game. And that was just the way that part of my childhood was. One of the things that became very meaningful to me when I was about 10 years old was that I got to get out of music class because I was bored, because I was an instrumental student, and there were some other kids who were also bored and becoming a discipline problem in music class, and a music teacher who had some free time at that same point in the day took us and let us start a little jazz combo. And it was a racially integrated group of boys, and we learned to play jazz together. It was a tremendously meaningful part of my life. And in fifth and sixth and seventh grade, we spent a lot of time together. We got put up on stage in front of community events outside of school as well, and that was really a fun and exciting thing to do, to be sort of a valued part of the community. And then puberty hit, and we still played together a little bit, but it got more and more kind of tense as the black kids got to be more friendly with other black kids, and the white kids got to be more friendly with other white kids, and we began to feel tension between us. And it was heartbreaking, and it felt inevitable. It felt like there was nothing we could do to stop the tide running out, you know. The church side of my life, actually a lot of my friends in that school, in that neighborhood, were Jewish, and I probably went to more bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs and synagogue services than church services in certain years of my life. I knew I was Episcopalian because the Episcopal Church was the church that we didn't go to when we didn't go to church. And we didn't go to church pretty much all the time. So that, but it was the Episcopal Church that we didn't go to, right? So I knew I was Episcopalian. That was something that I learned at home, but not because that's where we went very much. So coming to religious life, and especially to religious leadership as an adult, was not sort of just rolling into what I grew up with. I wouldn't say that it was a huge departure. It's just not something that had much support from my upbringing. And here I am in the Episcopal Church. It's the church that I knew was mine as I grew up, even though I didn't participate any as a kid.
And Kinzer, how were you brought up religiously?
I was brought up on drugs. In our family, I was drugged to church. I was drugged to Sunday school. I was drugged to afternoon worship. In our family, you didn't get a chance to decide about not participating in worship. It wasn't a question. As a matter of fact, all of Saturday was devoted to preparing for worship on Sunday. You could not get up in my parents' or grandparents' homes and do anything on Sunday that wasn't connected to worship. And if you were dumb enough to play sick on Sunday morning, the rude awakening was, you couldn't go anywhere or do anything for the entire week other than school. So, you know, on the occasion when one of my sisters or cousins tried to play hooky from church by pretending to be sick, they then had to forego all of the other things that we were allowed to do after worship on Sunday. I knew as a youngster, as a child, that I was going to preach. I knew as early as 6 or 7 years old, when on Sunday morning I would go to church and sit on the edge of my seat and literally memorize the sermons that were being preached. And then I'd come home that afternoon after we would have evening worship, because we had what was called Vespers every Sunday. And after we got home from Vespers, then I would assemble my sisters and cousins in the side yard of the house, and we would have church all over again. I would preach whatever the sermon was that morning. It got preached that evening.
And this question was brought to me a few months ago, and I kind of, you know, I thought about it for a little bit, and I was like, you know what, this makes a lot of sense. And the question is, why are Sunday mornings the most segregated times in America? And how do we remedy this? I don't know if it's a I don't think it's a problem, but you know, we equate religion with bringing people together. But on Sundays, if everyone goes to their place of worship, why is that?
I'll take a crack at that.
Please.
First of all, I will tell you it is a problem. It is a problem because we desperately need to be together. And the very fact that we are not together creates a unnatural tension between us as brothers and sisters. We are segregated on Sunday morning out of habit more so than anything else. We have lived together in this American experience, and in this American experience, in the Deep South where my family came from, the church was the one place where a black man could have his dignity intact. And early on, we pulled out of worshiping with white congregations primarily because it was a dignity in the racial ox that existed in the communities that we're a part of and that we come from. But I would tell you that for us who are believers in Jesus of Nazareth and who are disciples, it's a shameful display that if Jesus were here, physically present, he would upbraid us for. He would chide us. He would scold us. And I suggest that he might even fashion the same switches that he fashioned to clear the temple. He may do the same thing in our churches on Sunday morning.
And how do we remedy this situation?
It's got to be voluntary. We have to decide that this doesn't, it's not right, and that we're going to fix it. And then we have to go forward and boldly fix it. Get in the breach and do the repair work.
And Matthew, what do you think about the segregation, the Sunday morning segregation? What's your take on that?
Well, I think I share Kanja's ideal. I think I share his view that the difficulty that different Christians have worshiping together exposes a way in which we fall far short of our calling to be one in Christ. But I also trust in the mystical unity in Christ that goes beyond uniformity. And I believe that around the world, there are so many different ways of being Christian because of so many different cultural contexts that I think we ought to give each other and give ourselves a little slack, a little little break on feeling bad about not wanting to worship the same way as each other, because we have so many different ways of expressing the truth of God's love and upholding of us all, that it's probably sort of that there's a part of the differentiation between us on Sunday mornings that is okay, even though at the same time it's a shame. I don't know if you can have a both and, but to me it's a both and. And when I think about it, I think about the fact that Howard Thurman, who was one of the great thinkers in the middle of the 20th century about faith and race, he pastored a congregation that was intentionally racially diverse. And I think that's a beautiful thing, and I think there should be some of those. And I think there aren't nearly enough of them. I also think it's really hard to figure out how to do that together if all of the people who come together bring with them their extremely different experiences of church from each other. Even though I didn't go to church a whole lot, as I like to joke, the church that I didn't go to, the worship experience there was very different from the Baptist experience that Kinzer had. And one of the things that I really am ashamed about as a white Christian is that I have been in many conversations with other members of my church, of the churches where I have served, who have said, oh, we really need to do something to integrate this congregation. We really need to be more welcoming to Black folks and other people of color and different backgrounds. And as we talk, it becomes clear that they think it would be great if other people would come and worship with us the way we worship. And that is one example of white privilege in its glory. Like, we do it the way everybody should want to. You can come be part of our church. Just come and do what we do. And I think of the rich history that Kinzer described of his own childhood and of his family's devotion as an extended family to God in worship together in a way that is, you know, way outside my experience. And I wouldn't want to say, oh, you need to stop doing what you do and come do what I do. So the challenge for us to find ways to worship together that grow out of our roots in faith and yet grow into something new that accommodates everybody, that's a really challenging thing to do. And it's a sort of ideal that I aspire to, but I also don't think it's terrible when a group of people who love the same expressions of faith come together and worship differently than another group of people who love their expression of faith.
And Kinzer, jumping on that white privilege, what does white privilege mean to you? What have you seen? Can you give us some examples of it?
Well, white privilege is the inherent positioning that comes merely based on phenotypical qualities. There's no meritocracy involved. There is a expression used amongst my elders when I was a child that summed it up in a few words, and it was facetiously said. If you're white, you're right. And the expression was facetious because in a lot of instances, the persons that were being ridiculed were anything but right. But because they were white, there were not usually consequences to whatever actions they were taking that shouldn't be taken against another human being. And I heard that expression first in a rural Lexington and Oglethorpe counties, Georgia, which is the ancestral home of the maternal side of my family.
And you know what? These days, the expression is, instead of saying sounds about right, it sounds about white, for the exact same thing that you had just said.
Yep.
And Kinzer, from the perspective of an African-American man, what do you think you don't understand about white people in America?
Oh, I think I understand white people in America reasonably well, as a monolith. But individual human beings are radically different without any reference to the phenotypical qualities that we artificially identify as race. And what I know is that there are wonderful people everywhere in this country, and we're simply divided because politically at this point, it's expedient to keep us divided. If you read Black Reconstruction by W.E.B. Du Bois, he talks about how on the eve of emancipation, the white, poor whites and poor blacks were natural allies, but that the owners of the means of production made a bargain with poor whites and promised them that they would never be in the same condition as poor blacks. They would simply said to them, well, you'll never be us. This is the landed aristocracy in the South talking. You'll never be us, but we'll make sure you're never a Negro.
And Matthew, from your perspective, what is it that you don't understand about African Americans?
I'm afraid that it would be absurd for me to say that I even know what I don't understand. I think I take seriously and at face value what Kinzer just said about understanding white people as a monolith. I think one of the parts of privilege that I am beginning to recognize is that it has been a crucial survival skill for black people to understand white people, and it has been simply unnecessary for white people to understand black people. And therefore, I have had less of a sense of urgency about understanding my fellow human beings broadly rather than just one at a time. I'd have a hard time sort of saying what I do and don't understand. I will say, because I grew up in an integrated neighborhood and appreciated the idea of racial equality and racial harmony as a young person, some years ago I had a chance to mentor a divinity school student because I was serving a congregation in Connecticut near Yale Divinity School, and one of the students there was an African American named Terrence Taylor. He was becoming he was preparing to be ordained in the Episcopal Church, and he now serves in Florida, where he grew up. And Terrence was the seminary field intern in my parish in North Haven, Connecticut, for 2 years. And he and I talked about race and church for an hour a week for 2 years. I mean, and he said at the beginning of our time together, he said, look, I know that I am called to be ordained in the Episcopal Church to serve among black folks. What I don't know, but the Episcopal Church ordains people to serve everybody. And I don't know if I'm called to that. So I have to spend a while figuring that out, and you won the prize. St. John's won the prize. You guys get to help me figure this out. I was dazzled and so grateful to him for being that blunt about it. And so he and I talked about his experience and his dilemmas and his disappointments and his moments of grace and of hope through all of that with great intensity for that entire time. And so I feel like I've learned to listen to Black people because I've had that invitation in my life a few times. But I would not say that my position as a not only white but also male, well-educated and affluent person, there's just a lot that I haven't had to worry about.
Now, Kinzer, did you have any sort of experience similar to Matthew's during coming up in the Baptist church? Anything having like these types of conversations with white clergy members?
Well, no, because in our Protestantism, particularly in the congregational Protestant churches, we've been separated since the nation was founded. So when I met white clergy in the practice of ministry, it was almost never white Baptist. It was Episcopalians, Presbyterians. There were rabbis. There were Catholics. It was almost never white Baptist. I didn't meet any white Baptists until I was in college.
Oh, wow. Well, my final question is similar to the question of why Sundays are so segregated, but it pertains to the city of Buffalo in Western New York. The city of Buffalo remains one of the most racially segregated cities in the country. And looking through the lens of a religious leader, what needs to be done to build a more racially harmonious and equitable Buffalo and, to a larger extent, Western New York?
We just need to decide that it's the right thing to do. And then we need to become more like, for those of us who are Christian, we need to become more like Jesus. We need to just simply be radical in our approach to this and not allow anyone to make excuses, because that's what happens regularly. There also has to be an honest meeting of hearts and minds where you can just simply tell each other the truth. That's a huge problem for a lot of us, but it's a necessity if we're going to build a community that moves closer to what Martin Luther King called the beloved community, which is the community that Jesus Christ encouraged us to build here on earth.
And Matthew, what do you think? What can religious leaders do, or looking through your lens, what needs to be done to build a virtually harmonious Buffalo?
So what I'm trying to do at Trinity all the time these days is to model to my mostly white congregation an openness to learn about the history of racism and oppression and their lasting effects. The segregation in Buffalo didn't drop down from outer space, but it also wasn't just sort of natural preference. It wasn't just birds of a feather flocking together. There were legal structures in place making it okay for white people to spend their money in one place and not okay in another, and likewise for black folks so that housing became segregated, neighborhoods became segregated by law. And through legal regulation of banking practices. And so the consequences of that were not only that black people and white people didn't socialize with one another very much through the decades, but also that white people were able to pass some accumulation of wealth or at least a degree of financial stability from one generation to the next, whereas that has been much more of a challenge in black families for the most part. And I'm speaking in, you know, big generalizations, and there are lots of exceptions in both places, in both on both sides of that distinction. Nevertheless, we need to do exactly what Kindra said with our hearts, commit ourselves to one another, commit ourselves to being in community with each other in ways that require us to build new relationships and new associations. So with people that we don't know yet, assuming the best about each other and assuming that our prosperity together is going to be greater than the prosperity that one group can build for itself on the back of the other group, which has been such a pattern in American life over these last few hundred years. And we have to come to the point where white people as well as black people think that our lives are going to be better, all of our lives are going to be better, if we put an end to one group prospering at the expense of the other. And that means that the group that has been prospering at the expense of the other has to say, we think our lives are actually going to be better if we don't do that anymore, if we prosper together. So that's crucial. And that's a matter of heart and faith. And then on top of that, we have to work to dismantle the consequences of the legal structures. The legal structures got dismantled a generation or two ago, but the consequences of those structures, of it being difficult for people of color to pass on financial stability to their kids, that we need to address in terms of policy. And I think the religious community needs to lead the way. Kindra has said repeatedly, Jesus wouldn't put up with this. This isn't the way he would have us live. And the fact that we manage to make excuses and just sort of shuffle along the same way is to our shame, and we can do better. But it'll take courage on the part of white folks. It'll take dealing with some stuff that's pretty horrifying to learn about our past. And it'll take a willingness to trust people whose experience we find hard to believe even happened. That's a real challenge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I guess that's it on my end. Do either of you have anything else to add?
Thomas, this was good.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm blown away. Thank you. Thank you both so much.
Thank you. Thoughtful questions. Thank you. Thoughtful, challenging questions that require us to really to consider what we might do differently and how we might lead a repairing of the breach.
Yes.
I think the whole thing is,
you know,
go ahead.
I trust the mystical unity that we have in Christ to be a whole lot tighter and more beautiful than we can imagine. But I also it breaks my heart that it's not visible more. And with friendships, we can discover the ways forward. And for everybody's well-being and for the glory of God, we need to do it.